Seven household heads, I'm continuing to read from the dissertation, I will be brief, were Malamai, religious teachers with the power of intercession through prayer. Most men had a particular Malam whom they favored for advice and supernatural charms. All enterprising men developed a close association with at least one Malam, whose help they considered essential to material success. And let me show you some photographs of Malams. Here, once again, is the Meta Siri, the learned commentator on the Quran, the one able to most elicit in Hausa the Arabic meaning, the one who is able to compare the Quran with the Hadith of the Prophet Muhammad and with certain other books, legal books of jurisprudence. You see him here with two of his mature students. He also, it has to be said, was politically and ideologically a leader in the village. He was the, if you will, the ideological inspiration behind the majority party in the village, which was the populist party against the Hausa ruling class, whom they saw as often acting with injustice. Here you see a very ordinary day in the village, a very, very ordinary village scene. You have two of the other Malams, much less learned than Malam Audu, sitting and chatting. They would sit there at the front door here of Malam Edi, there, and there's another Malam. And people would walk by and sit and chat. And you can see a very ordinary, a very quotidian, continuous process of mental formation happening through these chance occurrences and these very ordinary interactions, you see. Chatting, gossiping about people's problems, local politics, but of course interlarded with belief. And finally, just another ordinary picture. Here is the son of one of my friends. Here is the father of one of my friends. And it's just another cold, dry season day in which people have time to learn the Quran. And he's just sitting there memorizing passages from the Quran. And in the evening, perhaps he would go to a malam, and this would be better translated for him, I'd say. But this was taken very seriously.
Malams developed a sense of community on new lines. They continually reiterated a standard of social practice and divine reward. Blessed are they who give generously. This legitimated and strengthened forms of gift exchange. Their public prayer and private counseling developed ties of obligation between richer and poorer families. It cemented people's consciousness of their membership in two overlapping communities, the settlement and the people of God. Well, that's the end to the reading from my dissertation. If we look back on this passage, which I've just read, textual analysis reveals a form of writing which is not as transparent as it seemed to me at the time I wrote it. Notice the claim to ethnographic authority rather than the disclosure of assumptions. features which were so compelling, quote unquote. Notice the cadence homogenizing communal life. All men, all adults, all boys. There is the hushed sense of a mystical life. Special gatherings, very strange. Key descriptive passages come from the lexicon of Catholicism. Beseech God, the power of intercession through prayer. And these various devices culminate in the statement of a unity which transcends the divisions of commoditized society, cemented people's membership of the people of God. At the time, I was not aware of these tropes. I still think them beautiful, for I suppose that what I was attempting to do, while apparently preoccupied with the objective and the holistic, was to construct the house of God in a far-off place, because he would not come to me in my own. Conclusions. I preface my conclusions with one remark. The parameter to this discussion is that my research was not focused on religion. Thus, I am talking about knowledge in passing. Yet such knowledge surely becomes crucial if the ethnographer is trying to develop a holistic framework for thinking about the topics which he did research. In his Social History of the Moral Imagination, Clifford Geert sought to unravel how the deeply different can be deeply known. Understanding a cultural construction very different from one's own seems to involve a strange sense of a passage from the singular immediacy of one life to the collective metaphor of another. One of the mysteries of cultural life, according to Geertz, is that, quote, other people's creations can be so utterly their own and so deeply part of us. One way of addressing this paradox is a study of the manner in which the ethnographer translates the categories of a different culture into his own. Long ago, Evans Pritchard pointed out both the necessity of and the difficulty in religious translation. A common or similar term, for example, supernatural, can have very different meanings in different societies. Surveying previous theories of primitive religion, Evans Pritchard remarked that they could not help us understand the significance for the practitioner of religious statements and acts. Among the reasons for this is that the theories assumed that souls, spirits, gods had no reality. Evans Pritchard distinguished between the majority of social scientists who assume that being illusions, religious ideas require a natural or social explanation, and the minority who, accepting the reality of spiritual beings, do not have the need for social or natural explanations. The non-believer will seek some theory to explain the illusion, whereas the believer among anthropologists will try rather to understand the manner in which a people conceive of a reality and their relationship to it. And he quoted Schmidt, "If religion is essentially the inner life, it follows that it can be truly grasped only from within. This can be better done by one in whose inner consciousness and experience of religion plays a part. There is too much danger that the non-believer will talk of religion as a man totally devoid of ear might talk of a beautiful musical composition." Parenthetically, it is surprising to me that Evans Pritchard did not explore more seriously Weber's sociology of interpretive understanding, centered on an account through ideal types of the content of the subjective minds, states of mind of social actors. More centrally, this paper makes no claim to musicality. And even if religious experience does impart a musical ear, that does not solve the problems of religious translation. Indeed, immersion in one religion can generate greater mistakes in the translation of another. However, at the level of moral imagination, deep engagement in one religion may lead the ethnographer to a general sympathy with the dilemmas or visions expressed in another. And that is what this paper has tried to convey. I end by attempting briefly a more rigorous account of the ways in which the ethnographer's religious quest can both add to and impede anthropological knowledge of the other. First, I would argue that a specific kind of reflexivity can expand our understanding of personhood and agency in the society being studied. This takes the ethnographer's self and turns that self so that it realizes other voices and their modes of deliberation. In my case, immersion in one local Catholic tradition led me to fasten on particular features of the local Islam in which I worked. Three features. One, fear of an unhappy afterlife modified the decisions that some Muslims took. Two, a quality of ethical worry led some Muslims to seek guidance from a spiritual advisor whom they judged more learned in the books of Islam than themselves. In order to develop scriptural criteria for resolving problems of conscience. Three, more subtly, the difference between my upbringing in the doctrine of free will and their clearly expressed concept divine will has led me recently to find their sense of agency in the sphere of intention. Even if, for some Muslim, acts are holy, are disdained, are predestined by the holy other, general wishes and more focused intentions are the product of human choosing. We sin in our feeling and in our internal thinking. They emerge out of the interior struggles of thinking creatures, individuated from each other in space. Goodness and evil come from a private interior world. The question, this reflection is really an inference. It seeks to render consistent my Muslim sense of fatalism with their assignation of moral approval or disapproval to other persons. This inference involves my personal weighting of the tone of voice in which they spoke of others as good or bad, a tonality which I judged to attribute responsibility. The question of tonality leads me to a second conclusion. The very specificity of the religious belief and experience of an anthropologist coming from one religious tradition attunes him to the specificity of the religious experience in another. The tones and textures in his religious experience, when presented, invite the reader to explore tones and textures in the religious experience of others. Thus, anthropology is sensitized to a religious experience whose emotion and voice have not been sufficiently explored. At the same time, this account is wholly consistent with admitting that prior religious experience, by turning the ethnographer in one direction, makes him less likely to appreciate formative circumstances influencing the religion that he's observing. For example, he might underestimate the influence of economic and political structures on religious belief or religious expression. But that is to say that the Catholic or ex-Catholic notices things about local Islamic belief and practice which the non-Catholic does not notice, or vice versa. Nevertheless, this account outlines an epistemology which remains based in observation and how observation is skewed. Taking the argument one step further, the subjectivity of one set of religious experiences can illuminate a different set. I would further argue that something else is going on in this account. The subjective movement which seeks to tie present reflections to past experiences of fieldwork shows how the retrieval of memories and self-beliefs can excavate elements, at least, in the beliefs of the other. But the elements thus identified of self and other remain elusive. They remain almost intangible. I want to end by arguing that intangibility is an aspect of inner experience. Expressed thus, an inquiry into the correspondence between religious knowledge of the self and of the other brings us face to face with the orthodox epistemology in current anthropology. Minds are public. We need to reconsider to what extent thinking is public. Broadly, we can discern two paths. First, we can continue on the path offered by Gilbert Ryle and furthered by Clifford Geertz. It advocates the exteriority, sociality, and physicality of thinking. In short, the anthropology of embodiment in the strong sense. Pursuing knowledge in this direction would certainly allow for observational comparison as a basis for conclusions about mental states. If it be accepted that mental states are in the domain of physical process and verbal utterance. In that case, the anthropologist from one religious tradition is simply in a strong position to point out resemblances with statements and practices in another tradition. He is merely, but usefully, pointing us in certain observational directions in the whole exercise of, to quote Clifford Geertz, tracing the curve of a public discourse. Or, secondly, we can part from this path and hold up to scrutiny the necessity or veracity of the assumption that, quote, meaning is public, Clifford Geertz again. Following in this direction, we soon discern that the road branches yet again. One branch accepts the partial interiority and privacy of thought, but not its immateriality. This branch is surely fruitful. It restores to anthropology a more complex account of human causation than that based only on an external concept of mind. Public discourses and public meanings all seem public, and so we have interpretation in observation until, disturbed and surprised, anthropologists discover that individuals kill their dearest, or they run away and disappear. Are they jumping from one public discourse into another? But we don't know where they went. Or they explode into rebellion. But it could not have been predicted from a close depiction of their discourse or discursive practices. Or, as in my village, they break down and cry in public, like El-Hajj Lawai at the funeral of El-Hajj Ibrahim. Something was brewing. Pache Geertz, quoting Ricoeur, the said of speaking is not equivalent to meaning when meaning is not said. The second final sub-branch is ancient, and perhaps for that reason it is out of fashion. Following in this direction, we would come to believe not just in the partial privacy and interiority of thought, but also in its immateriality, its no-thingness, in the philosophy of Meister Eckhart. Contra Gilbert Ryle, the ghost has always been in the machine. This possibility nags me, perhaps because, like Evans Pritchard's Azandi, I cannot think otherwise than I do, or perhaps because, in the search for Atlantis, I cling to Auden's enormous, simple grief. It is logically impossible to see how the ethnographer could ever substantiate the insubstantial. All he can do in logic, turning the phrase of Evans Pritchard, is to say that at a certain point the philosopher takes over from the anthropologist. But I would add, following Peter Berger, that the experiences which I have set in words are logically consistent, at least, with the merest whisper of angels passing. Thank you. I apologize for the length of that paper. I cut it and cut it and cut it. Are there any questions? I am both chair and speaker tonight. Or criticisms, alternative points of view.
Isabel Borge. I'm an assistant lecturer teaching art. From where my observation comes is the study of ex voto paintings, which was part of my dissertation for my master's degree. And in looking at these paintings, which are painted by vernacular artists and serve as a documentary of frequently of village life in Malta, it's just an observation that frequently the people who are praying are depicted in a stance kneeling, but with their palms raised, which is not the usual, that when we think normally that in the Catholic practice the hands are joined, and yet in these paintings you see people kneeling but with their hands raised as though in humility, but to to receive a spirit. And also, having visited some old sanctuaries in Malta and Gozo, I noticed that a very few old people, in the privacy of time of prayer, not in a mass, would be praying with their, would still be praying on their own with their palms raised. So that there is also a physical link. It's just an observation through that, I think.
Does anybody want to comment on Isabel's example? Because a comment I would make would be this. Clearly, belief and thought are expressed through the body. And clearly, if we were to follow some of the writings in the last 20 years of anthropologists particularly interested in a semiotic theory of emotion and of thought itself, we would have to say that there is a sense in which feeling as well as thought are bodily inscribed in the ways that Isabel has illustrated, and also culturally very specific. But of course, what I'm trying to do in the argument of this paper, at least in the conclusions of this paper, and the conclusions were written very recently, and I would like your feedback on those conclusions, is to say that it's not just a question of embodiment. There are different patterns within one religion, say the Catholic religion. There would be different patterns of kneeling, of praying, of holding the hands. And to a certain extent, what's going on here, I would argue, is an expression of an internal consciousness. There's a creativity going on. And it seems to me that a theory of feeling and of thought itself, which is totally based on embodiment, finds difficulty with creativity. It can only really see creativity in physical religious expression emerging through a process of imitation. Or perhaps it would add to the idea of imitation the idea of outside circumstance. But this to me is prima facie insufficient. There is an inner experience or inner consciousness also influencing the extent to which some people at church will pray standing or kneeling with the others, perhaps with their hands folded, whereas in private or in small gatherings, the people in your ex voto paintings will pray with their palms open. In a nutshell, I'm arguing that we need a concept of intensity to explain variation in religious physical expression, and a concept of intensity is not easy to elaborate without a sense of interior meaning, interior thought. Ivan.
Ivan Kallus, lecturer in English. I was very interested in precisely your conclusions. You spoke about the tonality of religious experience, but the tonality of the conclusions, I thought, was interesting. It did mark itself out from the rest of the paper, and what struck me particularly was the interdisciplinary, almost, quality of what you were saying. You were quoting people like Ryle and Ricoeur and Kurtz and so on and so forth, and they all derive from different disciplinary affiliations. And I was wondering whether reflexive anthropology can help really being interdisciplinary at all, or whether this was something you perhaps discovered during the writing of the paper itself.
I think the immediate answer to your question, Ivan, is that I discovered it in the writing of the paper. The paper was originally a paper on reflexive anthropology, but it benefited from having been read by students. And I have to admit, I benefit very much from some of the student comments in their essays on my paper. And I have, with due acknowledgement, incorporated some of these comments into the paper. And what I would say about the interdisciplinary quality of the conclusions is this, along the following lines. Very recently, Clifford Geertz in 2001, in his volume of essays, Available Light, heralded retrospectively a multidisciplinary zeitgeist. from what he calls, quote, the linguistic turn, and then through a long string of linguistic, literary, philosophical, and scientific masters and examples, to the somatic understanding or bodily understanding of emotion, quote unquote. And he goes on towards the end of the book in a different essay to say that recent anthropological theorists on the bodily quality of emotion are much more able to explore the cultural specificity of feeling, how, for example, Maltese feelings might be different from English feelings or different from Hausa feelings, than would an account based in a Cartesian sense of the difference or dichotomy between body and mind. And of course, what, getting back to your point about my tonality, what I am perhaps somewhat stubbornly arguing for in the conclusion is that the anthropology of embodiment as a multidisciplinary zeitgeist is far from radical. It has become acceptable. Rather than Cartesianism being, as it were, the orthodoxy, anti-Cartesianism, the collapse of the mind-body dichotomy, is now the orthodoxy. And so, of course, I'm suggesting that it's gone perhaps too far, that we need to rediscover the Cartesian dichotomy between body and mind. And I mentioned Meister Eckhart, 14th century theologian, his concept of no-thing. No-thing is true of God and is true of the human intellect, which is just one part of human consciousness, not the whole of human consciousness. And I mentioned this in passing.
Just have got some personal question. If you want, you don't have to reply. Why did you stop believing in Catholicism? Because you mentioned somewhere that 7 years before your field work, you stopped believing in Catholicism.
Yes.
It was because of the experience of philosophy as an undergraduate in England. That one did a lot of, I read a lot of philosophy. I mean, I was, that was my course. And in fact, the whole tone and temper of English philosophy was empiricist. And therefore the argument, as many of you know so well, the argument is that God is neither logically self-evident in the sense of a mathematical formula, nor is he empirically self-evident. There are other possible candidates for explanation, such that one has to conclude agnostically that one cannot, in any sense of the word true, be certain of the truth of the existence of God. And that's why, in fact, I was simply referring to the agnosticism of British philosophy, which influenced me very deeply. Yes.
Did the richest man of the village make his own successor? Did he inherit it?
That is a very big question. It's the kind of question my thesis really was devoted to, you see, rather than these issues which I have dealt with here. In fact, he did inherit more land than most other household heads, according to my research, you see. At the same time, if you want the kind of mindless nitty-gritty, which I love, my records suggest he inherited perhaps 30 acres. He now has over 300. Thus, I argue in the thesis, one cannot understand his riches in terms of inheritance only, nor can one understand economic inequality in Hausa society in terms of inheritance only. Rather, one has to come to terms with the wide-ranging process whereby money and the circulation of goods with money in markets as a result, not entirely, but largely of colonialism and more recently of global capitalism, have made it possible for some with perhaps better advantages inheritance, and others with acute ability, and this man, I can assure you, has acute ability, to become richer, and thus to buy land, to employ wage labor, etc., etc., etc. And yet, within the confines of my work, I argue that it would be a mistake to conclude that capitalism is taking over from a pre-capitalist economy. I argue in my own work, in my own research, for a hybrid development. And this hybrid development of pre-capitalist economic formations, peasant economic formations, and external capitalist influence, this hybrid really has to be understood in terms of the importance of polygyny and the dampening effect that polygyny has on the expansion of individual wealth. But it also has to be understood, as I've tried to argue in the paper tonight, in terms of the cultural value of the people, you see? So, yeah.
Carmel Vassallo, could you open it up a little bit, Paul, in terms of you obviously were centering on your village. Could you open up to the wider society in Nigeria?
I understand Carmel's question, his invitation. He's asking me to address the whole question of Islam and Catholicism in a much brighter sense. Well, first of all, I think it's very, very important.
And all children. I take it that the village is exclusively Muslim.
Now, yes.
Now.
Yes. It wasn't. It wasn't before. If you want me to open up the discussion more broadly, there are two directions which I would go, and I'll just go down one direction and see if this is what you're looking for. If it's not, we can explore other directions which you might find more important. What I'm arguing in the paper is that, in fact, there are very real affinities between Roman Catholic basic concepts and Islamic basic concepts. What I'm really trying to suggest, based upon the kind of microscopic ethnographic research which an anthropologist does, what I'm trying to argue is that there is very strong grounds for dialogue between people steeped in a Catholic culture and people steeped in an Islamic culture. I mean, if I were to stick my neck out, what this paper suggests, based as it is on one village, is that, in fact, the basic concepts are very similar indeed. There's a sense of interiority, a sense of divine will, divine law, a sense of moral obligation, and a critical concern with the intentionality of actions, which makes possible, at a strongly moral level, dialogue, so that we are getting in the press today, and also in academic commentary from Samuel Huntington and his like, constant references to the clash of civilizations. And as everyone here knows, we're getting from the politicians in the West talk of a crusade. Most unfortunate term, I would have thought, with all its implications. It all assumes the otherness of Islam. In this paper, I have argued that Islam is not other. Islam is profoundly similar. And if you want an extra plank in my argument, Carmela, which of course I can't advance or prove, it would be something like this, based upon my whole life experience. I would argue that Catholics are much more able to understand Muslims than, for example, Protestant Christians are, you say, because the emphasis is so very much on the interiority of intention and of choice, on guilt, on the intangible and yet at the same time real nature of the difference between good and evil, and on the need for this to be adjudicated through community tradition. Here I'm thinking on my feet as I go along in answer to your question, because you would then ask me, well, how is Protestantism different? And my whole experience of Protestantism...
I ask you, rather than go into Protestantism, is to sort of remain centered on this matter of Catholicism and Islam. Setting aside the Huntingtons of this world, perhaps we could simply center on the experience on the ground in Nigeria, how to square this cerebral, cultural, moral affinity, if you might put it that way, with the reality on the ground, which we know is very confrontational.
First, the confrontational nature of the reality has to do with differences which are profoundly economic and political. To look at the reasons why certain kinds of Islam are invoked by Hausa politicians, from the ruling class particularly, and certain forms of Christianity are invoked by politicians from southern Nigeria or from Christian ethnic groups. To look at the difference here is, I think, to be looking at the ways in which the need or struggle for power or the distribution of wealth in a political economy is legitimated by religious arguments. So I certainly could not argue that economic and political struggles for power do not influence the use of religion. And to that extent, Islam becomes an ideology. Christianity becomes an ideology. So that I think my argument here would have to be that any religion can be used, as Marx would say, ideologically. It can be used as an instrument to justify the particular political or economic position of the politicians who are leading individuals.
More or less one-way flow. You talk about economic and political differences and struggles being more or less then foisted onto and given religious interpretation. Is this not a two-way street? Are you completely excluding the possibility that there is a reverse flow from religion into other aspects?
I do see your question, and there your earlier request that I expand the discussion can be accomplished in a slightly different direction, which I think you would also want me to see me go down. Like this. In my village, the sort of Islam, the sort of interiority, the sort of moral worry which I have described got translated politically into a demand for a social justice in Hausa Adalchi. There was a profound, and there is a profound divide in northern Nigeria between the populist political parties and the parties of the ruling class. It has been argued that fundamentalist Islam in northern Nigeria, led by Sheikh Abu Bakr Gumi, is anti-Christian, violently anti-Christian, whereas in fact the way that religion gets translated into expression in my village is as a process of community gathering to wrest power from the rulers and to endow the community with ideas for social justice. Sheikh Abu Bakr Gumi did accuse Christianity of being the instrument of colonialism. May I be allowed to add personally that I think he was rather correct. It was, Christianity was the instrument of colonialism. But that was far from being the central point in his preaching or his writings over 30 years of his life. The central point was really a critique of the ruling classes of northern Nigeria, who were themselves Muslim. So rather than talk about a Christian-Muslim divide, I'm trying now to broaden the discussion, Carmelo, and indicate to you that there is a serious divide among Muslims along what I will call class lines, certainly lines of politics and economy. And in this clash, the sorts of Islamic ideas which we obtain in the international press and in international academic political writing emphasize fundamentalism, whereas as the old anthropological saying goes, in my village. But throughout northern Nigeria, my feeling is that the ordinary Muslim is not hostile to Christians. Let me end, if you follow the argument, I hope my argument's clear. Let me just end by referring you back to the end of my first long period of research. It was 1979. It was the first national elections in Nigeria after 20 years of military rule. And I was constantly fascinated by the extent to which Muslim traders and Muslim farmers would say, we prefer a coalition with a Christian leader against the rulers to establish justice to a purely Hausa party in which the ruling class, the Sarakuna, will continue to be unjust on us. So the sorts of ideological bending and formation of religion with which I'm sure everyone here is familiar from your reading of history or sociology, these sorts of ideological bending or formation also occur within Islam itself. Does that help?
very interesting, actually. Going now from the national to your village, as you put it, just as a point of information, what was the process whereby the Christian presence in the village actually came to an end?
The what village?
You mentioned that I asked you, and you indicated that it is now, or was when you last were there, a wholly Muslim village, but this had not always been the case. What was the process, historical, or political, or otherwise, which had in fact done away with the other presence?
Yes, well, again, since my paper began in 2001 for a naval gazing panel at a conference as a reflexive paper, let me begin subjectively. As I said in my paper, or I didn't have time perhaps to indicate it sufficiently, at the time I did my research, Muslims irritated me greatly. I would prefer, since there were so many non-Muslims nearby, Hausa as well, members of the indigenous traditional Hausa pagan religion, who drank copiously. I preferred to spend my time often with them. It also gave me the opportunity to indulge in my favorite pastime. But the point is, it's after leaving the village, it's really in this process of reflection on Islam that I've become much more positive about it. Back to your question. Partly, the reasons were economic. That is to say, if you want to make a lot of money, you have to be a trader. To be a trader, you have to obtain loans. To obtain loans, you have to be part of a sort of circle of trust, where there's a common mode of communication. And that mode of communication is Islam. This is a point made by a very, very well-known anthropologist, Murray Last, who, by the way, many of you heard lecture here about 3 years ago when he talked about the Hausa. So many conversions are by ambitious and able people who, in order to obtain loans and engage in trade networks, have to convert to Islam. But I don't follow Murray 100%. I still want to argue that some people convert through this process of interior debate and reflection. I'm trying to, I don't deny that there were economic causes involved in many conversions. And getting back to the anthropology of embodiment, which is so much being explored nowadays when people try to study emotion or feeling in anthropology. I don't deny that a process of bodily imitation goes on. I am quite sure that there today are no Muslims in my village, whereas in 1979 there were about 10 pagan. There are no pagans in my village today, whereas in 1979 there were 10 pagan families still left. Because of a process of bodily imitatio, whereby the pressure and the sense of strangeness of not conforming to the pattern leads you or physically pressures you into a process of expression of conversion. I don't deny, in other words, economic or psychosomatic causes being involved in the general sense in conversion. But I still want to hold out, Carmelo, for this Cartesian notion that some people convert, and that whole collective movements in politics and religion stem from a whole process of what I like to call interior debate. And that's what I've been trying to suggest today. That when we criticize Cartesianism, we mustn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There may still be what I call this intangible, private, or perhaps even immaterial inner world.
May I take this opportunity just to thank you very much for a extremely well-crafted paper, first of all, and a very interesting one, Paul.
There's one question.
Thank you. I agree with you that there's a lot to say about what goes on internally, but then again, many of us are affected by what goes on externally, and perhaps many of us would be frustrated because the intensity of what we feel cannot be fully manifested, you know, through our body. So, for example, you were very much disturbed by the fact that the person that went to see the body, because the person had died, broke down and cried, and that was really disturbing for you. Wouldn't you say that the body can leave more impact? I mean, what the body can manifest can leave more impact on the other person than what goes on internally, you know, what I'm trying to say. Much as there is this dichotomy between the body and the body tends to have more, leaves more of an impact.
If I understand your question correctly, you are arguing that the sorts of breakdown, the sorts of crying, the sorts of disruption of public conformity and public posture in this society stem as much from psychic trauma and bodily shock at the death of someone close, and emotionally close especially, as they do from any sort of interior sense of thought about that person. I think your point has got to be taken. I've got to accept your point. If I were to argue unilinearly that causation worked one way, that there was some sort of interior, intangible, immaterial intellect through which we think and feel on all occasions, I think I would be really going back to the Middle Ages, even more than I do in this paper. But I would argue for a balance between the two possibilities, and argue for a balance. How would this balance occur in this particular case? Well, something like this. Let's posit that over a long time there had been many interior struggles in Al-Hajj Lawai with concerned with Al-Hajj Ibrahim, many interior thoughts about him, at times very favorable, at times unfavorable. They were thrown together for trading purposes or farming purposes. There would have been times when the older man Al-Hajj Lawai, because he actually was the older man and he outlived Ibrahim, would actually have been in debt to Ibrahim. There would have been arguments over the debt. One can imagine a lifetime of association, as we do with those we know and love. There would be whole patterns of thought. So that part of the reason why the public psychosomatic or bodily posture or comportment, which is so important in Bourdieu's thought, is not maintained is because this, we must bear in mind this long-term interior process of deliberation struggle, whereby intentions are formed and whereby, I would argue, people are aware that they are forming their intentions, that self-conscious sense of the I. You not only think, but you are aware that you are thinking. You not only feel, but you are aware that you are feeling. So I would argue both ways. And let me just end with a small story. There's been a great deal of work done by anthropologists in the last 20 years on the whole process of conversion. And some of it is extremely fascinating, of course. My whole paper argues for bias. And with my own biases, there's certain papers strike me more than others. John Peel, professor at School of Oriental and African Studies, has just recently published a book on the conversion of Yoruba Nigerians to Christianity in the late 19th century. And this takes the form of diaries kept by Yorubas in the 19th century who were literate in Yoruba. They from early transcriptions of Yoruba, they learnt Yoruba in Western writing. And these are extraordinary diaries which convey an extraordinary sense of conflict. Shall I be a Christian or shall I continue to worship the old gods? I'm drawn to my old gods, but I'm drawn to the one God of Christianity. And what I got out of that paper by John Peel at a conference, which went into his book, what I got out of that paper is a strong sense of the social theater. We're all involved in a social theater. But behind the social theater of conversion or public expression of belief, there are all kinds of struggles going on. And I'm trying to argue that we engage in this theater. And so my story is that at the end of the solemn ceremony, I showed you the photograph, the tall man who led the Shafa'a Patia then turned to me, and in front of everybody in the house, he started singing my praise song. Now, my praise song is a very long praise song, and it begins by calling me Zaki Dan Zakanya, lion, son of the lionist, and ends by saying, Koya Hedeki Yakwana Say, mighty mortar, whoever swallows you sleeps standing up. And everybody burst out laughing. And I just think that there is in social life this constant movement back and forth between a private world of thought, feeling, and a public world. And I think humor, humor may be one of these delightful areas which cannot be reduced to somatic public comportments or imitations. Thank you very much.